This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The tsunami-swept Indonesian province of Aceh marked one of the basic milestones of recovery this week. Many of the region's schools reopened. In makeshift classrooms often, with few resources and much confusion, some of Indonesia's children took a step toward a more normal life. But it will be a long road in an area where many schools still serve as refugee camps and many families struggle with the basics. It's believed that somewhere between 30 and 40% of those killed in last month's tsunami were children. In the aftermath, the survivors are at risk from disease, psychological trauma, and from child traffickers. International groups are working in the affected areas now, but the needs are still great. Later in the program, today's rulings from the Supreme Court, one on sentencing guidelines. It has widespread implications for the federal court system. The other prohibits the government from holding indefinitely illegal immigrants who cannot be deported. But first, we'll talk about the impact of the tsunami on children. From their psychological health to their physical safety, and how this disaster may affect long-term social and family structures. We welcome your questions on the tsunami's effect on children, and we especially want to hear from people from South and Southeast Asia. How will the social structure of these countries cope with the new tsunami generation? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is UNICEF's Martin Dawes. He's in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Thanks very much for staying up to speak with us.
There's no trouble.
Let's start with the darkest thing that we've been hearing about, and that is the threat of child trafficking. Has UNICEF heard much about children being taken away from these regions?
Well, trafficking is a major concern generally in Asia in the best of times. We can talk about even into India, we can talk about Southeast Asia. Basically, in an emergency, when there is huge displacement of people, women and children become a lot more vulnerable, and we look for that. We can almost expect that, unfortunately. In Sri Lanka, from where I'm speaking to you, trafficking happened before the tsunami, mainly for economic reasons and some for supplying children for a trade with tourists.
You're talking about a sex trade there.
We are talking about the sex trade, but predominantly it was for child domestic labor. It was for economic reasons. There was some trade to the coast to supply tourists with sex with children. At the moment, we have had this tremendous shock in Sri Lanka. Children have been displaced along with their families. At one stage, it was 900,000 people into camps. 37% of the population of Sri Lanka are under 18, so they would have formed a significant proportion. Women and children displaced, vulnerable. There is more opportunity for crime against them. We think we saw that in the earlier stages. Since then, there has been more police protection on the camps. For 3 years, UNICEF has been working with the police to try and heighten awareness and awareness about crimes against women and children, and we hope that's been paying off, at least in the last few days.
Has there been, I wonder though, have the reports been alarmist? I mean, are there many cases that you know of children specifically after the tsunami being trafficked?
There have been some children, certainly in Sri Lanka, offered to sell, and they have been dealt with by the police. I don't think you can be alarmist enough, actually, because, for one thing, it's not actually about the numbers, it's about the act itself against individual children. And certainly in Southeast Asia, where you do have a particularly sad history of children and movement across borders, in these circumstances, I think actually it's far better to be alarmist and to watch for it and not to be in the least bit complacent.
Are there many children left without adult supervision, many orphans?
At the moment, we're looking at what probably a slightly better scenario than we feared, certainly in India and Sri Lanka. But what we are seeing is a lot of more children than we expected being left with perhaps only one parent. That, certainly in Sri Lankan terms, is appearing to be the concern that will affect their provision and how we deal with them, and groups like ourselves working with the government, we will have to look at this as a way of looking at the future and saying, how do we make sure that economically poor families who are now maybe left with one parent and several children, how are we going to make sure that they can stay together? And that will be quite a tough one.
Has UNICEF set up separate camps for children in Sri Lanka?
Not at all, and nor would we. Basically, the children were pushed back, along with their communities and populations, back from the shoreline, as it were. So they stayed with their... With their community, so that what you got in the camps was that they were normally with people they would have known and hopefully with relatives. To separate the children off from that, we felt here for a temporary time would have been quite a bad thing. Although camps are not a good idea, although there is opportunistic crime, at least they would have been with their families and relatives, and it is probably would have caused less trauma to have kept them in that situation.
We're talking about the tsunami's effect on children. Our guest is Martin Dawes, the UNICEF spokesman in Colombo, Sri Lanka. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Joe, who joins us from Annapolis, Maryland.
Hello.
Hi.
I agree with the guest that this is a huge tragedy, but the comment that I would like to make is that this has been an issue before the tsunami ever happened, that children have been trafficked for many, many years now. And these are very much ongoing issues, and they, quite frankly, this has exaggerated the issue, but it didn't create the issue.
Martin Dawes, is that right?
Yes, as I say, I mean, the figures for child trafficking and people trafficking across Asia is terrible. I mean, the numbers that come out of Nepal and Bangladesh, Nepal, which is conflict-afflicted, Bangladesh, which is poverty-stricken, into India, for example, is a very large number, and your caller is right. What has happened with the tsunami is that there's been a massive shock across Asia to communities, vulnerable communities in many cases. We have had some stories and indeed some police potential prosecutions of people who have attempted to sell children. So, yeah, there are now a lot of issues to deal with.
Joe, thanks.
Trafficking is one, and we're quite happy to see the focus on that because, as I say, a child trafficked, even one child, is unacceptable. There is a risk of more while there are communities that have been turned upside down and have been disrupted. This gives opportunity for opportunistic crime, but there are many other issues and many things where communities will have to deal with a future, a damaged future.
Joe, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Martin Dawes, before we let you go, there was great concern also about disease being epidemic in the wake of the tsunami. Has that materialized?
Certainly not as we feared in India or Sri Lanka. And I think this is a tribute to several things, because this is a rainy season here. It's a season when there are many diarrheal diseases. They have been dealt with very fast. That is a tribute to the government's monitoring system. It's a tribute to some of the aid, not only the aid that's happened now, but the fact that places like Sri Lanka were achieving more than 90% immunization. So in that sense, at least, children had some protection in depth. We're still monitoring. We're still watching. We're not complacent. It's very important. But as far as we are aware, as I speak now, according to government monitoring, a child has not died as a result of the normal diseases we associate with mass displacement of people in Sri Lanka since the tsunami, and that we're very relieved about. It is actually a relief that, based on the knowledge of what's happened before and what has happened, to put in life-saving provisions for children since the tsunami.
Martin Dawes, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Okay, my pleasure.
Martin Dawes is a UNICEF spokesman in Colombo, Sri Lanka. We'll let him get back to sleep and turn now to Alfred Ironsides, who's at UNICEF headquarters in New York City. And it's good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. Pleasure to be on.
To start with, why were such a large percentage of the victims of this disaster children?
Well, Neil, when you look across the entire region around the Indian Ocean, these countries have populations of children to begin with that are range from 30 to 50%, 50% in the Maldives, about 35 to 40% in India and different in the other countries around the region. So just demographically speaking, we would think that on average, the percentage of children who were among the dead would be about that high. When you look at the kind of disaster that these countries faced, and we've seen now enough of the video to know, those who were stronger, those who could run faster, those that could see the waves coming and escape somehow or hold on, were the ones that survived. And so children probably had a lower likelihood of being able to survive those floods. So in many ways, we expect in the end, the percentage of the dead to be disproportionately high among children.
And again, getting back to the question of orphans, there was great concern early on that many thousands of children would have been orphaned by the tsunami. Martin Dawes telling us earlier that at least in Sri Lanka, maybe not so bad. What are you hearing from around the region?
Well, it does differ from country to country for sure. We're certainly the most concerned about this in the Aceh region of Indonesia. I was just there last week, and certainly just from the site of the devastation alone, it would appear that there would be several hundred, if not a few thousand, children who lost both parents. Now, we just don't have the information yet, but in all the countries, surveys and registration of all the survivors is well underway now, and slowly, a picture is emerging in each of the countries. It's certainly emerging the slowest in Indonesia because they're just the massive number of dead there and how widely dispersed the survivors are. But we're slowly getting a picture. In Indonesia, we expect that the numbers of children who've lost both parents will be the highest of anywhere in the region, but we still don't have the exact figures.
We'll have more with Alfred Ironsides, more of your calls and emails when we return from a break. We're talking about the children who survived the tsunami and the risks they face now. If you'd like to join us, the number is 800-989-8255. Email totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're focusing for much of this hour on the special risks faced by children in the tsunami zone, from their vulnerability to traffickers to the long-term need to put their lives back together. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Alfred Ironsides, a spokesman for UNICEF. He's at UNICEF headquarters in New York City. And let's get some more callers on the line. And this is Jaya Ruwani. Jaya Ruwani is calling us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, Neil.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
I would like to know, I know in Sri Lanka, child labor is a common thing. And I grew up in a household where that was common, and when among the locals, if it is known, I think outside sources need to be educated them or try to get them to understand this is not a okay thing. And what kind of steps UNICEF is taking with the government officials to kind of get this into a state that we are according to the standards of the world?
Alfred?
The question is about child labor in Sri Lanka. Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, yes, certainly. It's all around the world, child labor is a problem. There's more than 250 million children who are involved in the worst forms of child labor, and it's important to emphasize that not all child labor is bad. Even in the United States, we have quite a long tradition of children taking part in chores around the farm and chores around the house, and so. We at UNICEF certainly view certain kinds of involvement of children in those kinds of activities as being quite healthy for them. But there are serious problems with children who are put in very hazardous forms of child labor, missing out on school completely. Their health is put at risk. And that's something that we're fighting in all these countries throughout South Asia, where child labor is particularly high. In Sri Lanka, I don't know exactly how our fight against child labor will play into our relief effort in the tsunami areas. I mean, I'm sure in the long run we'll be looking at those issues closely. I think right now we're obviously focusing on how we can get schools up and running again and make sure that there are schools and classrooms available for all the children who've been affected. And I think once that is accomplished, we'll be able to look at sort of the more fundamental issues of poverty and child labor that underlie many of the development issues in that country.
Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And let's go now to John, and John's calling from Columbia, Maryland.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll get right to the point, and I've got my question written down, so I'm going to read from my question here. What can the average citizen do to help in the effort to fight child abuse and slavery? And the party line when one contacts, the party line one hears when one contacts these relief agencies is, we don't want you as a volunteer, we want you to send money. Well, if one doesn't have a lot of money to send, how does one get involved? And if your guest can comment on the air, and then also provide a follow-on piece of information where one can go and get more information. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, John. We appreciate it.
Yeah, that's a good one, John. I do thank you for that question. There's a couple of things. I mean, in terms of fighting child exploitation, sexual exploitation, child trafficking, I wouldn't recommend that giving money is the number one thing you can do, actually. I really think that writing to your local congressman is probably a much more effective way of getting this issue on the agenda, at least in the U.S. Congress. I know that Senator Lugar, for example, from Indiana, is just beginning to push on how U.S. legislation can be stiffened and toughened up with regard to exploitation of children in emergencies. He just made a statement to this effect yesterday, and I'm sure Senator Lugar would love to hear from you, as well as your local senator and congressman, to say if you would look at Senator Lugar's website and see what he said yesterday, you'd probably want your senator to get on board with his proposals. So that's certainly one more concrete thing I could suggest. The other thing I think is to try and educate yourself about the issues. Child exploitation is a complex one, but we know that, for example, how we as citizens behave around the world, what kind of tourism we engage in. For example, some of these countries, you know, sex tourism is a serious issue with people from the United States and Europe going to places like Thailand and Cambodia and Indonesia to engage in a kind of a sex tourism. And so asking that U.S. Congress legislate those kinds of crimes as well would be another step you could take.
Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Kathy, who joins us from West Palm Beach in Florida.
Hi there.
Hi, you're on the air, Kathy.
Thank you. I just wondered if there's going to be a network set up where we can reach those children that need to be adopted. There's plenty of people who would like to adopt these children. In fact, I just came from a program where they talked about adopting Russian children, but I don't think we have the information or who to contact in order to do that.
Well, as it happens, joining us now on the line is Susan Cox, a Vice President of Policy at Holt International Children's Services in Eugene, Oregon. She joins us from their offices. I wonder, Susan Cox, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And can you answer Kathy's question?
Yes. Kathy, that's a question that a lot of people are asking, especially as they see the stories and hear about the children in need there. You talked about going to hear about orphans from Russia and other countries that need adoption. And those are very different children than the children who have been orphaned as a result of the tsunami. And frankly, I believe there will be very few adoptions, if any, from those situations, at least for now. The reason for that is these are children who lost their families intact. They were together. They weren't already in an orphanage. And so these children are going to be able to be taken in by family members, by relatives, or certainly within the community where they lost their parents. Also, there really were so many children who were victims of this more than parents. And so there are also families who lost children who will likely be very eager to help the children who lost their parents.
What do you tell people like Kathy and others who call, their hearts reach out to these children?
Sure. And it's a predictable response that's happened when there have been other disasters like this. And what they can do is certainly to help children in other ways. adoption is not the goal for children. Having a family is the goal for children. And very often, intercountry adoption is the only way for some of them. But that's not the appropriate response, at least at this time, for these children. There are many ways to help. There's organizations that have programs to help the children stay with their families. Holt is working in the southern part of Thailand in a village where about 1,300 families were impacted, and we have identified 40 orphans at this time, and there will likely be more. But we need to provide programs that will sustain those children and the families together. There's going to be a lot of effort to put together the infrastructure in all the communities and towns where this has happened, but there also must be rigorous attempts to keep the infrastructure of families and communities together as well. And decide which organization, do research, but look at organizations and find out how you can help in terms of programs that fit what you are interested in doing.
Just to follow on, Alfred Ironsides, I've read that many of the affected countries are trying to keep children from leaving right now.
Absolutely. The most important thing for these children is their stability and to feel safe. They want to, you know, more trauma is not what these children need. So they need to be in places where they are familiar, where they're safe, where they're with people that they know who are familiar to them. To imagine taking these children out to a new culture and language and all of the things that that would mean. We have about 30 families, actually, in the adoption process from Thailand. But these are families that have been in the process for a long time with children who were known, identified as orphans. The only way they would have a family is through adoption. And so it's really important that people understand that intercountry adoption is not the first line of defense. It is a wonderful opportunity for children when all of the other variables have been exhausted.
Kathy, thanks very much for the phone call.
Is there shelters being set up for these kids?
They're trying to, in the program that Holt is involved with, we're establishing foster care. We think that family-like care is always the best for children. Institutions obviously are not a good response, so we're doing everything we can to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so there'll be temporary foster care. There really are lots of people who are displaced. Even if you are a mother and father with children that came through this intact, you likely have lost your home, lost your livelihood. Those families also need support, and there's an awful lot of media right now about this. But when the stories stop being in front of us every day, the needs of these families are going to be certainly for months and years, and for some of them, through a generation. So please continue to think about and care for what the needs of these families will be long term.
Let's talk now with Megan, and Megan's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a volunteer for my local adoption agency, ASIA, Associated Services for International Adoption. I'm sure Susan probably recognizes the name. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to express how I have been feeling when people bring up the issue of orphans. I have a daughter that I've adopted from southern China, and it's such a huge step to take to adopt a child. And I completely agree with everything that Susan has said so far. But as a volunteer for the adoption agency, I can't help feeling like, oh, I have your orphans over here. Because I try to find families for children that were needy before the tsunami and are needy now and will continue to be needy.
I think that's a very good point. In fact, the irony is that many agencies, including Holt, are recruiting for adoptive families. They're not the tsunami orphans. And that's what people are so aware of because that's what we're seeing every day. One of the concerns, frankly, that we have with programs in 14 different countries is that we also don't forget the fact that there are children in need, desperate need, really, in many places around the world. So this has to be balanced. Obviously, this is the critical point now, but there are many children who really suffer every day.
Megan, thank you very much.
No problem.
And we'd also like to thank Susan Cox for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you, and we certainly are updating this information on our website daily, so invite people to go there as well.
Okay, if you'd give them that address?
Yes, it's holtinternational.org, www.holtinternational.org.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Susan Cox is Vice President of Policy and External Affairs at Holt International Children's Service and joined us from her office in Eugene, Oregon. We're talking about the children affected by the tsunami that swept through the Indian Ocean areas, the day after Christmas, just last month. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We've talked a lot about the immediate needs of the children affected. It's hard to begin to guess at the long-term effects of this disaster without an understanding of the societies that have been impacted. Nancy Barron is Director of International Training at New York University's International Trauma Studies Program, and we've reached her at a refugee camp outside of Freetown in Sierra Leone, and it's good of you to take the time to speak with us this evening.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
I know you've worked extensively in Sri Lanka. Is this a society where extended family ties remain very strong?
Absolutely. I think Sri Lankans are miraculous in the idea that they are people who believe in the extended family. That, again, we were talking about orphan children, but most children will have some kind of extended family. The usual in Sri Lanka is when there are problems, people help each other. And people don't run away from their extended families. They're very willing and able to try to help each other.
Now, some of these families, inevitably after this disaster, will be headed by women or maybe even by older children. Is that going to hurt their standing in society?
Well, we have to remember that Sri Lanka has also been plagued by a very long-standing war, so we have some precedent already set for women-headed households. There's a lot of programming that's been done in Sri Lanka over the last almost 20 years, which has done work with empowering widows and empowering older children as well to be able to take care of their families. So there's a lot of precedent already set there with organizations and local Sri Lankans who've worked in that way.
So do you have concern at this moment that these family structures will have been shattered by the force of that wave that struck?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that family structures will be shattered. But what we have to remember is that people are incredibly resilient. And when push comes to shove, people will do all they can to help each other. I think we've seen that already. And that families, extended families, will come forward and help each other. Community leadership, small villages and small communities where people have been together for generations, people will help each other. And I think what we're looking for children after disasters like this is to normalize their environments. Normalize means to try to return to normal as best we can what their normal life is. So I think what we're going to try to do and what people will do is rebuild and re-encourage families and communities to help their own children and help their own people.
Mm-hmm. From what you know of Sri Lanka and what you know of this disaster, what can you speculate about what the long-term impact might be?
Well, you know, it's always hard to speculate, but I would guess that within a matter of time, we will see people reconstitute themselves. I think that what your earlier caller was talking about is organizations trying to bring villages back together again and allow people to help each other. Again, what we're trying to do is encourage people to have self-help, empower people, retain their dignity. So my guess is that in a period of time, with the help of organizations and with the help of the local Sri Lankan NGOs and local Sri Lankan helpers and communities, people will begin to rebuild themselves.
Nancy Barron, again, I know it's late there. Thanks very much for staying up to speak with us.
Thank you.
Nancy Barron directs international training for New York University's International Trauma Studies Program, and we reached her at near a refugee camp outside of Freetown in Sierra Leone. And I wanted to bring you back into the conversation, Alfred Ironsides, as you look at these at the well-meaning help that is being offered by so many and the long-term impact. What do you foresee for UNICEF's role?
Well, the good news is that UNICEF is present in all these countries before this disaster, will be there long after the media attention fades. And that's our role, really, is to continually help these governments to develop their communities for all their children. It will be a very, very long haul. I must say I am concerned. I think all of us at UNICEF are concerned about what it will look like 5 years from now in some of these places that have really almost literally been wiped off the map. And frankly, if you look at some of the track record and other recent calamitous type disasters, be it the Turkey earthquake of 4 or 5 years ago, the Bam earthquake in Iran just last year around this same time, communities don't always spring all the way back, and it can be a very hard slog. And And so for many families, it can be a very difficult period of years of adjustment and economic struggle to get back to where they were before. So it will certainly be years and years of effort in all of these places that have been most hard hit.
Stay with us, if you would. We're going to take a couple of more questions on children and the tsunami when we return from a break. Also, we'll talk with David Savage of the Los Angeles Times about today's Supreme Court decisions. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the effect of the tsunami on children. Tens of thousands were killed on December 26th when the wave struck so many nations in the Indian Ocean. Now survivors worry about their health and their safety. Our guest is Alfred Ironsides, a UNICEF spokesman. He's with us from the UNICEF offices in New York. And let's take a couple of more phone calls. This is Madi, and Madi is calling from Fond du Lac in Wisconsin.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Very important show. I have a great deal of hope for at least the children of Indonesia. I am a student of Adat, which is Malay culture, and I understand that throughout time, as far back as I can see, there has always been a tradition of if a family could not take care of their child, another family would take that child in. Children are much freer to roam. A child, as soon as it's a toddler, is basically left to the community to take care of. There's a term, gangkat, which is to take in a child. Now the modern Bahasa Indonesia term for adoption is penggakatan anak, which means to take in a child. And so I do see a great deal of hope, and I believe in the culture.
I'm sorry, we're losing you there.
Oh, I'm sorry, I am on a cell phone. I hope that you got most of that.
We did get most of that, just missed the end. Alfred Ironsides, you were just in Indonesia, you were saying. Is this your experience?
Yes, it is. And, Indonesia is a very, the communities are very focused on extended family. And we've seen already a lot of faith-based organizations, Muslim organizations especially, have really responded very, very quickly, opening up their mosques, opening up their child homes to more children, volunteering of all kinds. So there is a very strong traditional family network, extended community network in Indonesia, and that's been a very significant part of the response so far, and I'm sure that he's right that it will continue to be an important part of the overall effort to help these families recover.
Madi, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. Indonesia has set up has said that it will set up Islamic schools for many of these children. Alfred Ironsides, after the last couple of years, Islamic schools is a phrase that has some negative connotations in this country. Is fundamentalism a concern here?
Well, I don't think it is at this point. I mean, I think we're talking about obviously some very mainstream Muslim institutions that are operating throughout that part of Indonesia. Of course, Indonesia is the largest Muslim population of any country in the world, and this is a mainstream religious institution throughout Indonesia, very important part of the fabric of society. Many of the institutions of daily life are Muslim, and so no, I wouldn't say that that's a concern at all at this stage. It's a part of the fabric of the communities that were affected, and it will be a necessary part of the regeneration of that fabric.
Let's talk now with Jody, and Jody's with us from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yes. I sponsor a child in Sri Lanka, and I'm particularly concerned about her, and I don't know how you get information on that type of thing.
This is one of the agencies that we read about in the newspapers or in magazines or on television advertisements that you sponsor a child in another country.
Right. Through World Vision.
Uh-huh.
Yes. I've been sponsoring her for, I would say at least 5 to 6 years. I think I started sponsoring her when she was 2 or 3, and she's about 8 now.
Alfred Ironsides, can you offer any advice on how to check on these children?
It's not easy right now, Neil. There's so much information gathering still going on in all the affected countries to find out, literally person by person, family by family, what was the impact, what lives were lost, who survived, where are they now, What kind of support do they need? Two thoughts I have, certainly, you know, the World Vision website will have some information available on sponsored children. But I also believe that the government of Sri Lanka has excellent and very thorough information on their website as well about every single community and village that were impacted. And so at least as a starting place, if you know where your sponsored child was living, there, there could be some very general information available about what happened in her village or community, because I know the government of Sri Lanka has some excellent details on their web.
Okay. I just wanted to mention the reason why I began to, you guys were talking about adoption earlier, and the reason I began to sponsor a child is because, you know, my husband's very busy, and we talked about adoption, but he never seems to well, that's neither here nor there, but, you know, we haven't been able to get it so we could adopt a child, so instead I decided to sponsor a child. At least I could feel as if I was doing something to help a child at that point.
Well, Jody, we wish you the best of luck in finding out what's happened.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Alfred Ironsides, we know you're busy. Thank you for your time today as well.
It's my pleasure, Neil, and I'd like to remind everyone that the UNICEF website is full of information on each of the countries affected and how all children are faring there, plus what we're doing. It's updated every hour, I'd say almost, with information coming in from our people on the ground. So a lot of information at unicef.org.
Thanks very much. Alfred Ironsides, UNICEF spokesman. We reached him at his office in New York.